Taiwan, and Tibet. One a smallish subtropical island, and the other a huge region of mountains and plateau, the roof of the world. Taiwan and Tibet share a common history. Both were once on the edge of China's Qing Empire, partly but not entirely under the rule of Peking, and later both shared a common enemy in the PRC. But despite that, Taiwan and Tibet were not especially friendly. That would change, and the turning point was the Dalai Lama's visit to Taiwan in 1997. This was a huge event, but actually, his older brother had made an important yet little-known visit here nearly 50 years before.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation.
Formosa Files.
Yes, Gualo Thunduk, the Dalai Lama's older brother, well, his second eldest brother, Gualo Thunduk, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, so apologies. Anyway, Thunduk visited Taiwan in 1950. Actually, it was more than just a visit. He lived in Taiwan for a while, and it's quite a story.
But we need to go back further in time. Tibet had enjoyed de facto independence since the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1911. And before that, it was a part of the Qing Empire, but John, like, how would you describe that? Tibet was a protectorate or a vassal state?
Yes, a protectorate or vassal state.
So as World War II came to an end, there was a question, what's going to happen to Tibet?
The Republic of China president, Chiang Kai-shek, and the Chinese nationalists asserted claims of sovereignty, but he did not have direct administrative control over Tibet in those post-war years. He was busy dealing with major economic and political problems in China itself, in particular trying to defeat the communists.
Yes, so let's turn to 1946. The Dalai Lama was 10, maybe 11 years old. An older brother, and again, we're sorry about this pronunciation, Gualo Thunduk, was about 7 years older, a teenager. He went to the ROC capital at that time in Nanjing.
1946, Nanjing, then capital of China. He was there to improve his Chinese language skills and generally educate himself for the coming future, which would see China an important part of Tibet's survival. And for the Chinese nationalists, this suited them. As a member of the Tibetan elite, Thunduk was a useful man to have on their side, a useful future contact, and Chiang Kai-shek went to great efforts to befriend him. In fact, the young Tibetan sometimes ate meals with the Chiangs.
In his memoir, The Noodle Maker of Kalimpong, Thunduk writes, quote, "Over time, I came to know the Chinese president and his wife quite well, and they came to treat me like a son. I visited their home frequently and often dined with them on weekends. They were unfailingly warm and gracious hosts, and I was always impressed by how well they treated their staff. They lived austerely. Dinner at the home of President and Madame Zhang was always simple, with only one or two dishes. Madame Chiang Kai-shek was a charming, strong-willed woman, always elegantly dressed," end quote.
A charming, strong-willed woman. Nice. Thunduk says that President Zhang was a generous sponsor, paying all his expenses, providing tutors to help with his studies, and giving him a large monthly allowance.
Yeah, so again, quoting from his memoir, quote, "His," so the president, Chiang Kai-shek, "his staff found me a comfortable three-bedroom house and provided me with a cook, servants, and a car with a driver until I learned to drive myself and sent the chauffeur away," end quote.
Soon after his arrival in Nanjing, Thunduk met a pretty fellow student, a Chinese woman a little older than himself called Zhu Dan, and she was the daughter of a nationalist general. 2 years later, they're married.
That was a little happy blip on the radar there, but China, at this point, was a sinking ship. They fled from Nanjing in March of 1949, a month before the city finally fell to the communists. Then they went to India via British Hong Kong.
On October 1st, 1949, Mao declared the People's Republic of China, The PLA are still mopping up resistance, and December 10th, Chiang Kai-shek left southwest China for Taiwan. The CCP and PLA, of course, now turn their attention to conquering outlying territories, Hainan Island, Taiwan, and Tibet. They would start moving into Tibet in October 1950.
Yeah, they didn't wait long, huh? 1 year after proclamation, moving into Tibet. But before
and they're in Korea at this time as well.
Oh, right. Yeah. Wow. Busy people. Before the invasion, though, Thundup had wanted to go to Beijing and try to do something to avoid the coming military clash, though he says he didn't have an actual plan. The British wouldn't give him a transit visa to pass through British-controlled Hong Kong, so he decided on another route. He and his wife and their three-month-old daughter would first go to Manila, and from there to Macau, Portuguese-controlled, and then from Macau into China.
April 1950, they're in Manila, but seemingly stuck. The Portuguese embassy refused to give them a visa for Macau. However, a newspaper correspondent for the Republic of China's central news agency, the ROC government newspaper, then based in Taiwan, heard about this. This correspondent invited the family to stay at his home, and he introduced them to the ROC representative in Manila, who said something like, "Why not go to Taiwan and visit your old friend, Chiang Kai-shek?"
Getting a visa for Taiwan was no problem. They were traveling on their old ROC-issued passports, and the Philippines had diplomatic relations with the ROC.
So they flew to Taipei, where CKS put them up at the Taipei Guesthouse.
Yeah, the Taipei Guesthouse. It sort of sounds like a backpacker hostel, but no, it's actually like a rather beautiful mansion.
Right. It was built in the early days of the Japanese colonial period. It's a few minutes walk from the presidential office building, and it served as the residence of the Japanese governor generals. Governor general, head honcho back then. Anyway, it's still used today for state visits and special events, and it's open to the public once a month, though it needs booking.
So Thundup and his wife paid a visit to Chiang Kai-shek, and of course his charming, strong-willed wife, Madam Zheng. Zheng told him something like, you should stay in Taiwan. You don't know what you do here. Well, I'll give you a nice job. You can run the Office of Mongolian and Tibetan Affairs.
Thundup said, thanks, but he was too young. He was only 22 years old, and he said he wanted to continue his studies, which had been interrupted by the war. After his China visit, I think he was headed to Stanford University in the United States.
Yeah, but he's not going anywhere anytime soon. When Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek says, you should stay in Taiwan, it's not really a suggestion. That's a command.
Right, so they were stuck in Taiwan. The ROC authorities, well, the president, he would not give them an exit permit.
But Thundup was not under house arrest or anything. He and his wife were free to go anywhere in Taiwan and were treated very well, but in Taiwan they had to stay. Which raises the question of, you know, why?
It seems Chiang Kai-shek and other KMT leaders were worried about this young, impressionable man that he might fall for communist propaganda and become a CCP tool. And for his own safety, it was best to stay away from Beijing.
Yeah, right. He might have ended up as a virtual prisoner under house arrest in Peking.
Right, yes. And better to be one in Taiwan, I think.
Right,
Being stranded in Taiwan was pleasant enough. He had a lot of time to kill, though. He spent his time visiting some friends, Mongolians, Tibetans, and Chinese, and he took up fishing as a hobby.
Yeah, this is cool. There's a quote from his memoir. The Danshui River flowed just behind our guest house, and I bought a fishing rod to try my luck, befriending a seasoned fisherman who was at the riverbank every day. He used a net to bring in generous catches of shrimp and introduced me to the basics of fishing with a rod and a reel.
A Buddhist and a brother of the Dalai Lama. Fishing. It's an odd image. Do Tibetans eat fish? Hey, Mr. Pescatarian, this is your area of expertise.
Okay, well, I don't know all that much about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but I know they aren't strict vegetarians. You know, where they live isn't all that suited to farming. Think about winters, you know, you'd probably starve. Fish in particular, though, that is a little strange. I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Thundup seems to have preferred shrimp to fish. Describing his first fishing catch, he says he thought he was reeling in a big snake. The old fisherman friend explained it was an eel, a tasty catch. So the two men traded catches, the eel for some shrimp.
Thundup had plenty of time for fishing in the Danzui River. He and his wife and their baby daughter were stuck in Taiwan for 16 months.
Quite a pleasant time, especially with Generalissimo paying for all his expenses. But frustrating nonetheless, being stuck in limbo. Frustrating hearing the bad news from Tibet, because during this time, the PRC invaded and conquered Tibet.
Yeah, the Tibetan government in Lhasa, they'd ask for military assistance. You know, anyone want to help? Britain? America? Anyone? Hello? Yeah.
Involvement in an Asian land war. No thanks.
Yeah, seriously. And one Asian land war quagmire was enough. As you noted earlier, the Korean War had started a few months earlier.
When PLA forces marched into eastern Tibet, Lhasa appealed to the United Nations for help.
The United Nations, yeah. Nobody was in a hurry to bring up the subject. To their credit, however, El Salvador did so, but the rest of the UN kind of just kicked the question down the road.
Chiang Kai-shek was in something of a bind. The Chinese nationalists supported the CCP's claims that Tibet was part of China, but the CCP were their enemy. You know, and in addition, the nationalists had their anti-communist credentials to protect.
So, a solution. Blame the Russians. Well, the Soviets. The KMT painted the Chinese invasion of Tibet as being Soviet-inspired.
Fun how history repeats, or at least rhymes, because Tibet had been forced open by the British expedition led by Young Husband, stemming from fears of Tsarist Russian involvement. But it turned out that was completely unfounded. But this time, Taipei had proof. They had military intelligence showing Soviet designs on Tibet. This proof included some secret instructions from Moscow to Mao Zedong in July 1950, with Stalin urging Mao to invade Tibet right away and to get his hands on the rich uranium reserves. They would be useful for making nuclear weapons.
Yeah, uranium is not just found anywhere. But getting back to Thundup in Taipei... One day, however, an American with whom he'd become friendly made a suggestion, and it was something like, I'll take a letter from you back to the United States, and I'll make sure President Truman sees it.
Truman, not a fan of CKS, was he?
Yeah.
So he's likely to be receptive to an appeal to pressure the KMT to let the Dalai Lama's brother go and study in the U.S.
So he, Thundup, wrote a letter. And it didn't take that long. 3 weeks later, the Nationalist Government Foreign Minister paid him a visit. The United States government had spoken to the KMT, and the result? The Nationalist Government had graciously agreed to let him leave for the United States.
Yeah, well, graciously, I think, yeah. No hard feelings from CKS. And his guests didn't just run off right away. They didn't immediately leave. His wife visited Hong Kong to see her family, and Thundup stayed on to be one of the first guests at the Grand Hotel, that ornate imperial-style building, which was Madame Chiang Kai-shek's project and opened in May of 52.
Your point is well taken. No hard feelings, indeed. President Zhang and his wife expressed pleasure that he was going to go study in the U.S. They had a farewell dinner for him, and... Chiang Kai-shek presented him with a check for $50,000.
$50,000 in 1952. That's one heck of a gift. In modern terms, that's at least, I just did a little calculation, maybe $500,000.
Nice. That would see pretty much anyone through university in style. So, where did he study?
Well, he had an offer from Stanford, but he decided not to study there or elsewhere. He thought he needed to go back to Tibet, even though it was under Chinese rule now. But before he left America, he spoke with the United States Department of State.
So he wasn't in America very long. He returned to Tibet, now under communist, PRC control, but then also in 1952, secretly headed out to India. His younger brother, the Dalai Lama, stayed in Lhasa. He was trying to make the best of PRC rule.
In the next two decades, Thundup would be a sort of go-between for the Americans and then the Central Intelligence Agency, better known as the CIA, mm-hmm. and also at times the ROC in the Tibetan Armed Resistance against the PLA. So yeah, he's a go-between between all these groups.
And India at that time was friendly with China, so these contacts were kept secret. Tibetan soldiers, get this, were taken for training to Saipan in Micronesia, a very unlikely place. And also to the U.S. later for training. Can you imagine people from Tibet, the first time they go overseas and they're on Saipan?
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. The CIA were running operations. And the KMT, yeah, they had some separate stuff going on too. Some in cooperation with the CIA. But yeah, some Tibetans came to Taiwan. I think they did some training in Danshui.
There were uprisings against Chinese rule in the mid-1950s in the Tibetan region. This was seen as an opening for KMT involvement. An agent contacted Thundup in India and said, hey, the KMT will drop agents into ethnic Tibetan areas and, will inflame this rebellion.
Yes, and a complicated situation. Thundup had asked for American support and also the nationalists in Taiwan. Taipei's response was favorable. And Taiwanese historian Lin Xiaoting has a good book, Taiwan, the United States, and the Hidden History of the Cold War in Asia, which covers this. He says of the ROC, a special task force was organized to recruit and train agent provocateurs to be airdropped into Tibet and to provide logistical support, including radio transmitters, ammunition, medication, and other needed equipment.
The Nationalists also established links with other anti-communist groups, ones that had little or no links with the Dalai Lama's government in exile.
Yes, some of the aid was more promised than provided, I think. I mean, after all, Taiwan was poor and dependent on U.S. aid.
So then why not get the Americans to provide machines and money? Well, reading from Ling Xiaoting's book, he says, quote, as the Tibetan Revolt intensified in the summer of 1958, Chiang Kai-shek broached the subject of launching joint actions in Tibet with Ray S. Klein, the CIA station chief in Taipei. He proposed airdrops and airborne activities in the Kham area, and with American support, an expansion of anti-communist guerrilla bases run by local ethnic minorities. Chiang specifically requested several B-17 bombers that were to be crucial to the success of Taiwan's airborne operation.
The Americans said no. They knew the KMT were not popular with the Tibetans or the Indians.
Then in March 1959, we see what's known as the Tibetan Uprising. This was no minor action in far-flung regions, but an actual revolt in the capital of Lhasa. Mass protests met with force, bloodily suppressed, and the Dalai Lama made his secret escape to India. The 14th Dalai Lama fled from Lhasa to India over the Himalayas with his family and some of the Tibetan government.
The 1959 revolt and the flight of the Dalai Lama were big international news, and especially in Taipei. For Chiang Kai-shek and other nationalist leaders, here it was, finally, after 10 years since the founding of the PRC, a major rebellion against the communists. And this was at a time when the Great Leap Forward had thrown China into chaos and starvation.
Yeah, Chiang Kai-shek is giddy. He was so excited, he almost said the I word.
The I word?
Yes, I for independence.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, so almost but not quite. He declared on March 26th that the Tibetan people should have, quote, the right to determine their own future, end quote.
Funny, he didn't feel that way about the Taiwanese, though.
Yeah.
The KMT top brass were so happy with events that they actually revealed their hand in covert operations to the international media. Yeah, they were boasting to the world, we played a big part in the revolt in Tibet, yeah.
CKS wanted the Americans to seize the moment. He asked for airlifts of military supplies to the insurgents, airdrops of troops of groups of 100 to 200 men. He was sensing a moment to light the fuse for his retaking of the mainland.
So Ray Klein, right? We talked about him a second ago, the CIA chief in Taipei, talked to Washington and then reported back to Chiang Kai-shek.
This is going to be a very disappointing no.
actually, worse than a no. Ray Klein broke the news diplomatically. He told Chiang Kai-shek, you know that stuff you claimed credit for, you know, covert operations and all that? Well, actually, that was more to do with our operations, you know, CIA. We've been doing it for years. It was us, those commandos. We trained them, for example. We got the Dalai Lama out of Tibet. Thanks for your offer of help, but we'd prefer to keep Taipei out of it. Thanks, but no thanks.
Yes, a little paraphrasing there on your part, Eric, but yes, yes. That's the basic message. So CKS was angry and stunned, but still determined to get involved. He sent agents to India to see Thundup, but he turned down CKS's offer of assistance, I guess fearing Indian and U.S. anger. But other Tibetan groups were more receptive.
Yeah, CKS offered a home to Tibetan refugees who had fled to India and said Taiwan would take 3,000 refugees. The Americans were opposed to this. So the KMT goes, okay, what about Plan B? This would involve relocating 3,000 Tibetan refugees to KMT guerrilla camps in the borderlands of Thailand, Laos, and Burma. The so-called Golden Triangle, where they produce a lot of illicit substances.
Yes, don't go there. Okay, another story. So the United States isn't giving the ROC much assistance or even face when it comes to the ROC on Tibet.
The political status of Tibet was a sticking point between Taiwan and the U.S. The U.S. State Department pushed the KMT to renounce its claim to Tibet and recognize its independence. The Americans were lining things up for, you know, a possible U.N. proposal for Tibetan independence.
Yeah. The KMT ignored the question, basically doing the equivalent of a no comment. And meanwhile, they lobbied other countries to kill the proposal at the United Nations. This was around 1960.
While this diplomatic battle continued, the KMT discussed various Tibet plans. The hardliners wanted military action. Some moderates suggested maybe we should give the Dalai Lama residence here in Taiwan.
The Dalai Lama in Taiwan. Quite a thought. Him and those 3,000 Tibetans and others.
I wonder where he would have chosen to live in Taiwan if he'd come. I'm going to guess like somewhere up in Nantou.
Yeah, up near like Qingjing Farm.
Somewhere replicating, you know, the kind of climate and altitude of his homeland.
Okay, anyway, it never happened. So with the United Nations setback, President Eisenhower stepped up covert operations. And Chiang Kai-shek also continued covert work, doing military support, gathering intelligence, cultivating leaders, and strengthening ties.
But in 1962, India and China fought a border war. It kicked off in October of 1962, the same time as the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, so India and China, former friends but now foes, this changed their relationships with the Tibetan exiles and also the ROC. In his memoir, Thundup says that in the mid-1960s, the Indian Intelligence Service asked him to help establish contact with the KMT.
Yeah. And am I wrong, John, but the Chinese didn't do so well in that border war with India, did they?
Correct.
Thundup wants to establish contact with the KMT, and this would involve a trip to Taiwan. And in the book he wrote, quote, "I paid a visit there so secret that it was never officially recorded. Nationalist officials met me on the tarmac at the Taipei airport and whisked me away without going through the formalities of immigration and customs. I paid a pleasant courtesy call on the Generalissimo and Madame Zhang, who were delighted to see me and happy to learn about the overture from India." So remember, Indian intelligence was trying to get in contact with the KMT, and Chiang Kai-shek is pretty happy about this.
Yes, happy. He's still president, but he's in his mid-70s, so his son Jiang Jingguo was in effect running things. And Thundup gave the Indian request to Jiang Jr. And very soon, the deputy director of ROC intelligence made a visit to Delhi in India. The start, I think, of cooperation between the Indian and ROC intelligence agencies.
Thundup mentioned a promise by the two Jiangs, so both daddy Chiang Kai-shek and son Jiang Jingguo, for opening an office of Tibet in Taiwan. But there must have been some change of heart because it was never opened.
And Thundup did not visit Taiwan again for several decades. In the early 90s, he finally returned in his capacity as the head of the governing council of the Tibetan government in exile. This visit was in order to meet President Li Denghui.
Li Denghui was very sympathetic to the Tibetan cause and extended an invitation to Thundup's brother, the Dalai Lama, to visit Taiwan. This historic visit would take place in 1997, but that's a story for another time. Once again, thank you for listening to Formosa Files. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
I'm John Ross. Bye.